For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
They don't try to rescue the people. They tell always human rights. Because they have the black hair, or they don't have the green or blue eyes, they didn't rescue these people.
The death toll in Italy has reached 67. After a boat carrying up to 200 refugees in Europe fell apart over the weekend, at least 16 of the victims were children. The shipwreck came just days after the Italian government seized a rescue boat operated by Doctors Without Borders. We'll speak with MSF about the tragedy and Italy's crackdown on humanitarian groups. Then to the student debt crisis. Conservative justices on the Supreme Court appear set to block President Biden from eliminating or reducing student loan debt for millions of borrowers. As the court heard oral arguments, student debt activists and lawmakers rallied outside the Supreme Court.
Is it just for us to look at the problem of student debt through a racial justice lens? Yes. Is it just for us to look at the student debt crisis as an economic problem in this country?
Yeah. Plus, we go to Alabama, where hundreds of striking miners are returning to work at the Warrior Met Coal Company this week after nearly 2 years on the picket line. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Tuesday in two challenges to the Biden administration's student debt relief plan, which could give tens of millions of federal borrowers up to $20,000 of relief each. Several conservative justices expressed skepticism over the plan, while liberal justice Sonia Sotomayor blasted the Republican states that brought one of the lawsuits, arguing 50 million students will suffer if the program is rescinded and that the Education Department should be making decisions about how to handle their debt rather than judges. Activists gathered outside the court. This is Maddie Clifford of the Debt Collective.
The same billionaires and corporations that don't want you to have higher wages, that want to bust your unions, that don't want you to have decent and free medical care, that want to dictate what you do with your body, that want more tax cuts for the super rich, they're the ones that also want you to stay neck deep in student debt.
Later in the show, we'll speak with debt collective organizer and writer Eleni Shermer. Elsewhere in Washington, D.C., the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing Tuesday for the Equal Rights Amendment, which would codify gender equality in the Constitution. The ERA was passed in 1972, but was never ratified, as conservative opponents have argued the deadline for ratification is passed. The ERA would not only help address persistent inequality in areas like wages, it could also protect abortion rights and the rights of trans and non-binary people. Constitutional and legal experts say Congress has the authority to change the ratification timeline. This is lawyer and constitutional scholar Kathleen Sullivan speaking at yesterday's hearing.
It's my belief that under Article 5, Congress proposed it, 38 states ratified it. It is the law now, and the only thing standing in the way, is the congressional deadline, which Congress set in 1972, altered in 1978, and has the power to change today.
Tuesday's hearing came as Washington, D.C. Circuit Court struck down a case which would have compelled the U.S. Archivist to publish and certify the Equal Rights Amendment as part of the Constitution. In Nigeria, Bola Tinubu of the ruling All Progressives Congress Party was declared the winner of the weekend's presidential election, but his opponents have disputed the results, alleging fraud, while election observers and voters have cited delays, closures and violence at voting sites. Turnout was less than 30%. Tinubu, the former governor of Lagos, lost the vote in Lagos State to the Labor Party's Peter Obi, who came in third overall. Obi had received much of his support from young voters who saw him as the candidate of change. Atiku Abubakar of the main opposition party, People's Democratic Party, received the second highest number of votes, according to Nigeria's Electoral Commission. The new president of Africa's most populous nation will have to face the ongoing security and violence crisis, as well as double-digit inflation and unprecedented oil theft. Iranian authorities say they're investigating after a series of poisonings at girls' schools. The latest such attack struck a school in the city of Pardis in Tehran province Tuesday. Nearly 700 schoolgirls have suffered toxic poisoning since November, and what authorities have said is an attempt to shut down education for girls and could be linked to the nationwide women's rights protests in Iran that took off in September following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody. No students have been killed in the attacks, but many have reported respiratory problems and other health effects. Back in the United States, President Biden's tapped Deputy Secretary of Labor Julie Sue to be the next labor secretary, as former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh leaves his post this month to head the National Hockey League's Players Union. The nomination of Sue, a civil rights attorney and former head of California's Labor Department, was welcomed by progressive and pro-labor groups. She would be the first Asian American to serve as secretary in Biden's cabinet. Amy Allison, founder of She the People, said, quote, Julie Sue's commitment to ensuring equity and compliance to her work as a labor expert and attorney fighting for the rights of women workers nationally makes her the ideal choice to lead the Labor Department. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Meanwhile, Democrats reintroduced the PRO Act Tuesday for the third time. The legislation would protect the right to organize and penalize companies who engage in union busting. This is Senator Bernie Sanders.
Under this bill, it will no longer be cheaper for corporations to break the law than to obey the law. At a time when we are seeing, and here's good news, more and more workers wanting to join unions, it is unacceptable that over half of workers who vote to form a union don't have a union contract a year after their union victory. That will change under the PRO Act.
In Mississippi, Republican Governor Tate Reeves has signed into law a bill that bans gender-affirming health care for transgender youth. The legislation criminalizes providing transition-related care to minors, frees health insurance companies from having to cover gender-affirming care for youth, and blocks public funding for clinics and institutions that offer this type of care. Mississippi is at least the fifth state in the United States to ban health care for trans youth. In just the past month, Utah and South Dakota enacted trans health care bans, and the Oklahoma House just passed a similar measure. Two other bans in Alabama and Arkansas are currently being challenged in federal court. In Arkansas, the legislature has also voted to advance a bill that criminalizes trans adults for using public restrooms when children are present. In Tennessee, Republican Governor Bill Lee is facing backlash after a high school photo of him dressed in drag went viral just days after he said he plans to sign a bill that criminalizes drag performances. The measure bans drag shows from being performed in public or in front of children. Nationwide, at least 14 bills have been introduced, including in Arizona, Texas, and Tennessee, targeting drag shows, with performers and supporters saying these measures have worsened harassment and threats from far-right groups. Several drag storytime events for kids at libraries and other public places have been targeted by right-wing groups, including armed protesters. Some 30 million people across the United States are seeing a portion of their federal food assistance taken away today. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, had increased benefits as part of the emergency response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some households could lose hundreds of dollars each month, even as families continue to face increased food prices, and analysts warn the cuts will bring millions to a hunger cliff. Congressmember Pramila Jayapal said, quote, it's unacceptable. Poverty and hunger are policy choices. It's time we step up and do more, she said. and in Chicago. Mayor Lori Lightfoot conceded Tuesday evening after losing her bid for re-election. An April 4th runoff will pit Paul Vallas, the former superintendent of Chicago Public Schools, who's backed by the Fraternal Order of Police, and progressive Brandon Johnson, a Cook County commissioner and organizer for the Chicago Teachers Union. This is Paul Vallas speaking to supporters last night.
We will have a safe Chicago. We will make Chicago the safest city in America.
In Chicago's election, Paul Vallas received about 34% of the vote. Brandon Johnson placed second with just over 20%. On Tuesday night, Johnson criticized Vallas's record.
He is backed by the same forces who have done nothing as crime has paralyzed our city. He's backed by the same supporters who have failed to enforce the consent decree, even after Adam Toledo, Laquan McDonald were killed.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot placed third in Tuesday's race. 4 years ago, she became the first Black woman and openly gay Chicago mayor. But she came under intense criticism during her term, including for her handling of the pandemic, racial justice protests, the Chicago teacher strike, crime levels, and skyrocketing property taxes. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, you're there in Chicago, where this race took place yesterday for the mayor of Chicago. A lot of firsts. You know, you had Lori Lightfoot, who was the first African-American woman mayor of Chicago, the first openly LGBTQ mayor of Chicago, and now she becomes the first incumbent mayor to go down in, what, something like 40 years. Can you talk about the Vallas versus Johnson runoff and the significance of what took place?
Yes, Amy. Well, Lori Lightfoot was deeply unpopular, as you mentioned. Her first term was less than stellar, I think, for most voters felt. But this is shaping up now. The runoff on April 4th is shaping up to be a sort of classic battle between progressives on the one hand and centrist and conservative forces in Chicago on the other. Paul Vallas is a former CEO, not only of the Chicago Public Schools, he was also he had a stint as superintendent of the Philadelphia Public Schools, as well as in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. He's a big backer of charter schools, and obviously that is a major issue that the Chicago Teachers Union, from which Brandon Johnson emerges, is deeply opposed to. He's also had significant backing from real estate and business leaders. And his main issue, really, or as some people say, his main three issues were crime. He's promising more police officers on the streets. He touted in last night in his election night speech that not only is his wife a police officer, one of his sons is a police officer, another is a firefighter, and he clearly is seeking the more conservative votes, not only among centrist Democrats, but also among those who consider themselves Republicans in Chicago. Brandon Johnson, on the other hand, was strongly backed by several key labor unions, not only his own local, the Chicago Teachers Union and the Working Families Party, but the American Federation of Teachers, the parent union of CTU, poured in lots of money, as well as did the Service Employees International Union, the healthcare division. So this is basically key labor unions were backing Brandon Johnson, as well as progressives. And he was emphasizing that you fight crime as well by investing in communities and in alternatives for young people. So it's really shaping up to be a classic progressive versus conservative battle. The problem is that that Vallas did get 34% of the vote. And so Brandon Johnson is going to have to really be able to get backing from a lot of the others who lost, including Congressman Chuy Garcia, who came in fourth with 14%. What Lightfoot is going to do and her supporters are going to do is going to be critical. So it's going to be a tough race between now and April 4th to see which vision of urban governance wins out.
And do you see this as a message to the country and to Democrats? Because this is actually a battle within the Democratic Party, the police union versus the teachers union in Chicago.
Yes. Well, I mean, it is, because Chicago is such an important city in the nation. But we've been seeing this now play out in a lot of urban races, where a wing of the Democratic Party finds itself to some degree more in sync with some views of some independents and conservatives around, once again, putting the emphasis on fighting crime rather than trying to deal with the conditions that give rise to crime and with the social safety nets of urban cities. So we're going to be seeing this play out over and over again. And Chicago could be a bellwether as to how this will develop in the future.
Well, we'll continue, of course, to follow this. The runoff election is April 4th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to the death toll in Italy, reaching 67, after a boat carrying up to 200 people seeking refuge in Europe fell apart over the weekend near the Italian city of Crotone. At least 16 of the victims were children. Around 80 survivors were pulled to safety after they were found in the water, clinging to pieces of the ship which had departed the Turkish city of Izmir a few days earlier. Some of the survivors are children who lost their whole families in the shipwreck. Rescuers said many of the passengers were from Afghanistan. Others came from Iran, from Syria, and from Somalia. On Tuesday, some relatives of the victims went to a sports hall in Crotone to identify the bodies of their loved ones.
The police show us a picture and say, "Do you, it's your family?" And we should to give answer for yes or not.
And did you recognize them?
Yes, yes.
And what do you think when you saw them?
What should you think? It's happened.
Okay.
I have two daughters. My children, 5 years since last.
Another relative of the victims questioned why more wasn't done to save the passengers on the boat.
They don't want to rescue the people. They tell always the human right, because they have the black hair, or they don't have the green or blue eyes. They didn't rescue these people. I don't know all the people they telling about the human right. Because they have the black eye or black hair, they weren't human.
Since 2014, almost 26,000 people have died or gone missing in the Mediterranean, but many governments have responded by criminalizing rescue efforts by humanitarian groups. Just days before the shipwreck off the coast of Italy, the Italian government of the far-right leader Giorgia Meloni approved a new law making it harder for humanitarian aid rescue vessels to carry out their missions. Doctors Without Borders, MSF, said their rescue ship was detained by Italian authorities just last week as part of the new measures, blocking it from going to sea to save lives for at least 20 days. We're going now to Brussels, to Belgium, to speak with Caroline Willeman. She is deputy head of mission for search and rescue at Médecins Sans Frontières. That's Doctors Without Borders. Caroline, welcome to Democracy Now!, this horror at sea. And your ship basically confiscated, detained by the Italian government. Explain everything that took place.
Yeah, indeed. So it's an extremely, extremely cynical situation, and I can only follow the words that the person was speaking earlier of where do we see our right to speak about human rights. So indeed, on Thursday evening, our ship was informed by the Italian authorities that we will be detained for a period of 20 days. We will not be able to carry out our life-saving work, which is indeed a result of this new legislation that was put in place by the Italian authorities. And the detention actually is only part of already the way that this legislation is reducing our capacity to carry out rescues. We are now also forced to return to port as soon after one rescue, which means that we can rescue much less people every time that we go out to rescue people. So just to give you an idea, before this legislation, we used to rescue, on average, we used to do more than four rescues and rescue over 280 people each time, while now we're allowed to do only one rescue, which might be 50 people up to 100 people. And the question is, of course, where are those people who are not rescued by us? So indeed, our work is being blocked. While unfortunately these horrendous tragedies keep happening, I want to make clear as well that there is a lot more media attention in this case because the tragedy happens so close to Italy. But this is something that happens on quite unfortunately regular basis, also very often closer, for example, to the Libyan coast, of people leaving the Libyan shores. And very often that news will not even reach Western media.
Could you talk about the anti-refugee and anti-immigrant policies being enforced by EU nations like Italy, especially given the fact that right now many of these same European countries are opening their doors to refugees from the war in Ukraine, and yet they're increasingly shutting the doors to refugees from the global south?
Exactly. I think what we've seen in the past year in terms of the welcoming of refugees fleeing Ukraine, to be very clear, which is exactly what we should be doing. And that is exactly the welcome that anybody fleeing persecution, fleeing war deserves, I don't even want to mention what I might want to believe in the little humanity that we have left to receive people, to welcome people, but also according to international law. It's not solely a humanitarian imperative, let's say. And so indeed, what we've seen over the past year also shows that it is not a matter of it not being possible. It's a matter of lack of political will, because the open doors policy, again, so very rightly applied to people fleeing Ukraine, has not been applied to people fleeing from other countries. And so it has been several years that in Italy, amongst other countries in Europe, indeed, the work of NGOs has been made more difficult. In previous years, there has been criminalization of individuals working for NGOs. We've had to face discriminative practices of port state controls. So in itself, no issue with a port state control. In itself, no issue with, let's say, also COVID quarantine measures. We're a medical organization. Of course, we support medical quarantine measures when they make sense. But you have to ask yourself some questions when measures are being applied much more strictly for search and rescue NGOs than for others. And so this is what we see now as well in this new legislation that has come out that targets only NGOs doing search and rescue work. Keep in mind that the vast majority of people who arrive in Italy, either they manage to arrive autonomously or they are rescued by the Italian Coast Guard, but the legislation targets only NGOs, which says quite a lot. And so that's where we have the main point of being allowed to do only one rescue. And also in the last few months, every time we are assigned a port, we are assigned ports that are hundreds of kilometers away from the area where we would normally disembark people. So this is adding several days to our journey with survivors on board, but also as we then want to return to the search and rescue area to do our work, it takes us more, like we lose time, I think is the correct way of saying it, because every day that we are not in the area where normally we do rescues, people risk to lose their lives. People also risk to be intercepted by Libyan Coast Guards, which are to this day still supported by the European Union, by the Italian government. And people who are intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard will be returned to Libya. They will be returned to detention centers. They will be abused. They will be extorted. They are essentially returned back to the hell that they are trying to flee. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, in terms of those refugees who do make it to Europe alive, what kind of conditions do they face in countries like Italy or Belgium, where you're from? You've also worked in the refugee camps in Greece. Can you talk about the conditions that they face?
Yeah. So it's been a few years now that I was working in Greece, but I think there we've seen a very similar, in the end, it's all part of a wider European deterrence policy. So basically trying to deter people from approaching Europe. I worked in a camp for asylum seekers, an official European camp for asylum seekers on the island of Lesbos. There was space for 3,000 people. At its peak, there were 20,000 people there. So you cannot imagine how overcrowded it was, insufficient access to water and sanitation facilities, insufficient space for people. It became very insecure because of these conditions. And at this very day, as a Belgian citizen, I know that a few kilometers away from my door, there are several asylum seekers who have a right to access to reception centers by the government, are sleeping in freezing temperatures on the street, and have been for about 6 months at this point. So indeed, it's what we see happening in Italy is unfortunately part of a wider policy at European level that has been going on for many years.
And I remember when we went to Calais, what was the largest refugee camp, and I think all of Europe at the time, called the jungle by the people inside. It looked like the countries that the people were from were a map of the countries the United States had bombed, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Syria. Can you talk about who was on this ship? Who died?
So the information that we have so far is indeed Afghanistan is for sure a country that comes forward. Iran is a country that comes out. Then there's a few different nationalities that have been named. I've heard Somalia being mentioned as well. I've heard Pakistan being mentioned as well. And I think this is very much in line also with the people that I've met on board of our rescue ship who were coming out of Libya, despite the geographical location of Libya. I met people also coming out of Syria. We met people from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, and the same thing when we were on the island of Lesbos. Last time I was there, the majority of people arriving were coming from Afghanistan. We have people coming also from Eritrea, from Nigeria. So many people very clearly fleeing countries in conflict. And then when speaking about the route to people who come through Libya, there for sure we also come across people who have moved towards Libya because they don't have any economic opportunities in their own countries. So they look for work in Libya, but then they get trapped in this horrendous cycle of exploitation, basically, of forced labor. And that's what eventually pushes them to leave Libya, where the only way out is indeed taking the sea. And let it be very clear, in general, people understand very well how dangerous it is, but which only goes to say how dangerous the places are that they're fleeing from. I think it's the cliche that always comes back, but there's a reason why it's a cliche, because it's so very true. Like, people wouldn't put their children on a boat if the sea did not seem like a safer option than the place they are fleeing from. I have worked in Afghanistan myself. So yeah, I think at some point you start seeing the whole range of the places that people leave up to the places where people arrive and the horrendous welcome that they receive, or the lack of welcome that they receive.
Caroline, we just have 30 seconds. What are you calling for? When is the Geo Barents, your ship, being released by the Italian government? But go broader than that.
We should be released in 15 days. Obviously, we should be released now every single day that we are not there. People might die. People might be returned to Libya. We need state-led search and rescue. And most of all, if anything was shown by the drama on Sunday, we need safe passage and safe and legal routes for people fleeing to reach Europe alive. At the very, very least.
Caroline Willeman, we want to thank you for being with us. Deputy head of the Mission for Search and Rescue at MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, that's Doctors Without Borders, speaking to us from Brussels. Next up,